Give the floor to Maria Paula. Let me briefly introduce her, her research area, and her political work. Maria Paula is a Mozambican scholar at the Center for Social Studies at the University of Coimbra in Portugal. She had her academic training in both in Russia and the USA. She received a master in history at the St. Petersburg State University, 1987, when it was still the USSR. And then she completed her PhD in anthropology at the Rutgers University in the USA in 1999. She's engaged in the study of African and international politics, colonialism and postcolonialism. And especially we have want to emphasize the politics of knowledge production, which is the core of her interest. At the heart of her commitment is a collaborative approach to knowledge production, and in this context, to explore dialogues and articulations between academic scientific knowledge and community-based ways of knowing. Her standpoint position is, therefore, logically, to decolonize knowledge, the narrative of belonging, and to contribute towards the epistemologies of the global South. And here is also the link to her personal trajectory. Maria Paula was born in the colonial context. She witnessed firsthand the conflicts associated with the transition to independence in Mozambique in the aftermath of an armed struggle for liberation. And also to mention, she published in 2019 a book together with Boaventura de Sousa Santos with the title Knowledges Born in Struggle, Constructing the Epistemologies of the Global South. Before Maria Paula starts her presentation, just briefly some technical details. Please make sure that your microphones are switched off during her presentation and during her talk. And then, as we said before, it would be nice if you wish, and if it doesn't cause any technical problems to you, if you could switch on your video so that we, instead of seeing black tiles, could see your faces. That would be very kind. Thank you. The presentation will last at approximately 45 minutes. And after that, we'll open the floor to your questions. We will not make a break because I don't think it's worthwhile. And then I'll give again some more details how we proceed with regarding the questions. And now I'm handing over the word to Maria Paula. Please, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much. I really do apologize that I didn't think about religious festivities because they are normally something I don't pay attention. So I didn't pay attention that today was an holiday for some people. I do apologize. Just to introduce what, and I'm very thankful for the invitation, but just to add small things to explain how sometimes it's complicated to talk about the past. And I'm just going to use an expression that was developed relating to the question in Germany, because the past is another country. I was born in Mozambique, where my father was born and where my daughter was born and my grandson was born. But to make a long story short, my father, myself, and my daughter, the three of us, attended the same building, the same primary school, but with three different names, depending on the condition. So the things kept being renominated. And I thought for a while that it was a problem of Mozambique, because I was born in a city called Lourenço Marques, which is now Maputo. But later on, I went to the Soviet Union that no longer exists. I studied in Leningrad that no longer exists. It's St. Petersburg. So this kind of the world is moving and we are losing our roots is a problem that sometimes we face. And that's why I was interested in your research group and questions of creolization, contact zones, and so on, because quite often we have to go back and make sense of things that otherwise seem to have been lost in another dimension when we can't grasp them. So that's why I'm really grateful for this invitation, for the possibility to engage in a dialogue with you, because it's not very often that I have the possibility of talking to people to one of the regions that was for a long time one of the supporters of the liberation struggle and construction of another political project that Mozambique long ago left behind. But it was that period that I thought we have to discuss, because there's still a lot to be talked about and to be opened up. So I think these talks like this one can play somehow a route for renewing our commitments to understanding our common humanity, and where this discussion of creolization is fundamental. Because after all, the Creole condition highlights the qualities of pluralism and transformation that sum up the reality of the African continent and challenges very much this approach that insists in seeing Africa through the lenses, above all, of the ethnic division that makes quite often nonsense to understand the complexity of the continent. So I see my presentation as a contribution to a broader debate on the interconnectedness of Africa with the world, beyond quite often the overshadowing presence of colonial representations. And colonialism, we are talking about a quite recent presence. We still have a problem with Western Sahara in the African continent, but the last colony to become independent was Namibia, and it was not long ago. It was in 1990, 1980, it was independence of Zimbabwe. So we have this still complicated transition regarding the overshadowing presence of colonial representations. And that's why I think to think from the South requires to unpack the various levels of ontological and epistemological violence that quite often we don't pay attention to. And this is a condition for a healthy North-South dialogue. So when I was, and I thank very much Joshin for inviting me, and when we started changing messages, usually we send an abstract and send a title, and we don't think very much later on about what we submitted. And when I went back, I said, okay, what did I suggest? I suggested that we talk about North-South dialogue and some cautionary remarks to understand why am I so interested in this dialogue. And second and above all, why African experiences are not experiences of global international impact. That is my big question. Why everything we do, it's always of local impact. Why am I saying this? You probably heard in the news there was an attack in northern part, in extreme north of Mozambique on Monday, on the 24th in Palma. It was a terrorist attack, but it never got to the broad media to discuss which is the current condition of terrorist attacks in African context. There are at least 25 countries with terrorist insurgents. So there are certain things that we have to ask why those questions never become part of this global awareness regarding terrorist attacks. So that is one of the problems. The people keep dying in my country. We have above, currently, I was looking at the data yesterday, 300,000 people internally displaced. So this is important for us to think about why memory and history are so important, and why historical memory is part of the nexus of African negations, of colonial misinterpretation on one end, and how it's important for us to reconstruct endogenous representation of the continent to contribute to another narrative, another interpretation about us. And by this, I suggest that history is essential. It should not be optional or incidental about how we Africans perceive the continent. as an epistemological province of the world in dialogue with other provinces, being it Americas, Asia, Europe, and so on, and not something as an empty signifier that we quite often don't know what it is, and it's quite often catch-all meaningful to refer to anything. So these were the questions. And already starting to call your attention to some of the problems that I think are really relevant. From the point of view of the recent history of critical thinking, I think two major problems, challenges today, and I was listening to Margot and I understood my very bad German was capable of understanding. But one of the elements that I think it's important, it's the global north. And when I'm talking about the global north, I'm talking about the two margins of the North Atlantic. It's no longer geopolitical center of gravity of the world. And with it came the pressing force of decolonization, which is a concept that I think we need to discuss more about as a broad movement with continuous migratory movements of peoples and ideas. And my big problem is why ideas are still stuck inside Africa. They don't become acknowledged by the world as suggestion to change the world. Indeed, in Europe, where I currently work, and I've been working in Europe for a while, a key question that one has to deal is with the representation of Europe in the world, recognizing that what we call a global world is composed of multiple epistemic provinces with multiple epistemological grammars expressing distinct social experiences. As Margot shared with you, it's by my own trajectory, with my academic training, having taken place both in the Soviet Union and in the US, it became clear from the beginning that educational projects proposed to us by these countries shared similarities that enable us Africans to enter the academy on our own right with knowledges and experiences that were not just raw data, but knowledges thought and produced from other perspectives that did not fit the modern moderns of rationality. In short, what we could move, we moved, we studied abroad, we studied in the global north, we travel north, but our ideas and knowledges remain hostages to colonial perspectives in both contexts, being it the former Soviet Union or the United States. Together with African colleagues, we experience various episodes of cognitive injustice. For example, the imperial version of linear time that insistently represents us, subjects of the South, is underdeveloped. And this is a sophisticated word for immature, living in territories where concepts such as revolution, social and cognitive justice, democratic changes supposedly do not apply. They have to be brought in from somewhere else. So this is a question that we experienced, we were trained, and then we moved out. Just to overcome this condition, this abyssal thinking, and the first time this idea of abyssal thinking between the supposedly rulers and the ruled, where it was addressed by Sukarno in 1955 in the Bandung Conference, it still dominates very much our academic environment. And I think an epistemological shift is necessary, and that's why I was hired to teach in Coimbra, and don't take me to explain the complexities of being in Europe, trying to explain the world from other perspectives. But this shift is necessary in order to recover the idea that there are alternatives to the various crises and voids we are facing. And it's important to recognize bearers of potential alternative knowledge and ways of knowing and ways of living. So this tension between being and living, it's something we also need to think. So in this talk, and I'm going to be very precise about the three questions, I think we have to address in order to understand what is going on in the world, where are we talking from, what knowledge counts as core canonic knowledge, and we do it how to move from a certain authentic monocultural approach to knowledge, addressing possible paths to provincialize the supposed universal narratives, towards worlding history, as Polan Tujin, Gungi Wationg, Gayatri Spivak, or Dipesh Chakrabarty, just to name a few, have been claiming. And finally, the third question is the repercussion of revolutionary change in Southern Africa as a contribution to the liberation of the world. And just to paraphrase Archie Mafeji, if what we from the South say and do is relevant, to humanity, then the international relevance of our actions are guaranteed. So this is the tension that I want to discuss with you. And here, initially, a clarification. The South I'm speaking to, it's not geographical. It's an epistemic South. It represents everything that has escaped and continues to escape, resist, and defies domination or destruction by any attempt, monoculturally speaking, of a project that seeks to exercise hegemonic power, especially we know that it's more than rationality that is associated with capitalist project that seeks to impose a single narrative to interpret the world, because a single narrative is the easiest way to dominate the world, because automatically we create an abyss of fracture, defined that the others that we don't know have no knowledge. And that is the worst element of the colonial approach, especially modern colonialism, was the transformation of people on the other side, on the colonial side of the world, as people with no knowledge, with no capacity to work, the big children of colonialism that had to be saved by the European colonizers. And we could talk about it, but that will be another project. So that's why I think it's important to talk about the enduring legacies of capitalism and colonialism, because the two go together. It's impossible to detach colonialism from capitalism. And this is a suggestion that when William Dubois was working in Germany in the early 20th century, came to the conclusion. It was initially discussed by Karl Marx in his later works, but I think it's a condition that later on Lenin, Sun Yat-sen, and so on developed. But I think it's a condition that we need to return to and to discuss how much of capitalism is capable of developing without the colonial violence that is one of the key imprints of modernity. So let's start with this idea of what is universal in knowledge and universalization. Scholars such as Michel Rouve-Trouillot or Suleiman Bachir Diagne, they have highlighted, and if there are any names that you don't understand, just tell me. I would like to know about that person and I can share some of information, because what I'm trying to do with you is to reflect about the African continent with Africans. So it's to put the things a little bit on perspective. So this took Michel Rouve-Trouillot, which did a lot of work on for the Caribbean, or Suleiman Bachir Diagne, they have highlighted that evidence against a universally shared notion of knowledge would indicate that epistemology in the epistemology of the North is simply an exercise in the way the global North talks about knowledge, and not an initiative in discovering the foundations or coherent methods for having justified true beliefs. So it's just an approach of a certain project, but it's not the whole project. This reflection about the very notion of what counts as universal knowledge is very important, because one has to be careful in distinguishing between what is universal and what is universality. Yeah, along these lines, Bachir Diagne mobilizes a distinction that I find very important. There are two types of universals that we activate in the academy, especially in social sciences, but not just. So there is this verticalized universal, polarized, and the lateral universal of center, and very much horizontal. The first defines an apprehension of particularity from a position of centrality that aims never to be contested. The center is always right. The second is conceived as a journey between persons and communities, a migration of ideas without absolute points of reference from which they are judged or evaluated. And I think this is an approach one should follow beyond any attempt to nationalize knowledge. If we really look at history, and I'm talking about from the 8th, 9th, 10th century, Athens, Paris, Baghdad, Fez, Timbuktu, Cairo, are all areas of philosophical reasoning where universes of multiple references were connected and still are connected, drawing together intellectual plural traditions. And these movements of debate, transference, and translation were never linear and continue not to be linear. They are intertwined, they cross seas, oceans and continents, complicating the roles and implications of the academy. And the great colonial division between humanity humanity of the Logos and the Anthropos feeds this distinction between the imperial language of civilization, which is science, and indigenous languages that express the incommensurability of ways of knowing. We can't know everything. Everything we know is mostly ignorance. So this is the big distinction that I think it's important to bear in mind. The challenge to think with the global south, and now I'm following Boaventura Sousa Santos' challenge, calls for the recognition of plurality of epistemological aspiration. It is therefore an epistemological rather than a geographical south that consists of multiple epistemologies which are produced when and where useful experience are generated in different historical, cultural, and political contexts that need to be theorized in order to justify the options. By occupying the epistemology, the silence oppressed social groups, those who usually do not count as human and whose knowledge are usually not valid according to the modern northern thinking, because they are just raw data, not knowledge, claim their humanity by representing the world as their own in their own terms. And this is the condition of creolity that most of us in the world share, but it requires a way of recognizing our ignorance as a precondition to relearn with the others whose knowledge we don't know and we want to know. So this is epistemic struggle, is a struggle to surpass the colonial library that has been theorized by Valentin Mudimbe. Indeed, most of what we know about Africa, there are the texts that we use in the libraries and the archives, are what Valentin Mudim defines as the colonial library, a still leading corpus of interpretation of Africa that represent a whole body of knowledge, aiming and translating and deciphering the African object by the global north in order to dominate it. It's not African knowledge, it's European narrativology about Africa. And this goes in line with the syndrome of discovery, the belief promoted by certain academics outside Africa, that they have discovered everything about Africa, rather than recognizing that much of what they have supposedly discovered have long been known to Africans. So this is something that we need to bear in mind. From an evolutionist perspective, the modern globalized world is the world that the North created and sought to impose as the most advanced form of institution, including some of its last products and some of which we all share, like the modern nation state, which is a product of the global north, the modern university, which is the Napoleon or Bolton University. But these are appropriations of forms of being and ruling the world by the global north. We can't say that only two forms of university existed in the world. Actually, one of the oldest still functioning university is the University Al-Qarawin that is from the 10th century that was established by a woman in Fez, currently in Morocco. But these are the problems about appropriating a certain particular institution of the world and proclaiming that suddenly it becomes the single form. And therefore, we naturalize a certain institution as part of a certain political project. So this is some of the problems that we need to address. And associated with this appropriation of certain experiences and institutions came the imposition of imperial languages, a single conception of time, of space, of property, and of nature. And worse came the syndrome of abolition, as if, for example, the abolition of slavery or of any degrading human condition presented initially as a discovery, not made by the sufferers of or the oppressed, but rather by the degraders that were moved by this remorse or something morally less decent, as Jacques de Pelchin has been told us. So who abolished slavery were not the movements from the global south that's fought against it, namely through the Haitian Revolution and so on, but it was indeed the product of the legal structure of Europe itself. So these are the syndromes that still very much impose upon us when we are thinking about how to decolonize the academy. And by extension, the decolonialism of metropolitan Africanists still embodies very much this abolitionist syndrome, since it was a belated discovery of an exploitative immorality long condemned by the colonized. Again, through this approach, the global north reinscribes itself at the center without exposing the relations of exploitation and domination that are inherent to the system. So the invention of the North as the exceptional center brought with it the emergence of the peripheries. And the construction of this peripheries has to be seen as a political, epistemic, and ontological exercise aiming at generating an explicit definition of geopolitical and epistemological space of the North as the center. We never speak indeed about the North, but we are constantly defining the other as the underdeveloped, the barbarian, the tribal, the ethnic. So by default, the center is everything that the others are not. And this is a condition that we need to start discussing. And the African continent, seen from this particular perspective, has in recent centuries been the symbol of the periphery of the world, because underdeveloped and backward on the path of the civilizing process, whose reference continues to be the reference of European project. And I have nothing against this attempt of the Enlightenment in developing an interpretive framework of the world. It's a North Atlantic project. My problem is when this approach is imposed as a prescriptive recipe for the rest of the world. And this has political, epistemological, ontological implications that we need to address. Therefore, my problem is when, based on these premises, more than scientific rationality insists on imposing an abyssal fracture that divides the world between the global North, that is prescriptive, and local Souths, that are the Souths in their diversity, are spaces whose knowledges supposedly only have local traditional value. And don't think I'm thinking nonsense. The last UNDP report that just came out 10 days ago, it's entitled The Next Frontier, Human Development and the Anthropocene. It completely omits any reference to development from another perspective where nature and societies are linked, being that the case of Suma Kalsay in South America, Dumbutu in Southern Africa, or the Swadeshi in India. These are sophisticated conceptualizations for whom reciprocity, relationality, and the profound respect of the differences and an emphasis on the complementarities among human beings and between human beings and nature are fundamental conceptualizations that an international institution such as UNDP seems to be incapable to understand, that represent indeed most of the world. And we are talking about a large part of South America, a large part of Africa and Asia. So this report, in my view, illustrates how the epistemic colonial project continues to function nowadays. And here I'm following Peter Ecke approach. I address colonialism as a power structure that subverts, destroys, reinvents, appropriates, and replaces anything it deems an obstacle to the agenda of the colonial capitalist domination and exploitation. In short, it's an epistemological, ontological project that insists in creating loud silence in history, or more accurately, I would say, perpetuates oppression rather than liberating the world history to which we all belong. Therefore, that's why with Boaventura, we are developing at the center with lots of colleagues across the world, this idea of the epistemologies of the South, because if the epistemological diversity of the world is to be accounted for, other theoretical frames of reference must be established, anchored in other epistemologies so that we can actually promote a democratic dialogue among equivalent contexts that can indeed represent the realities of the world, not just of the South, but of the world in its diversity. And this sort of interconnected knowledge that is produced in these contact zones across culture is one of the key moments, I think, for a constructive dialogue based upon interpolitical, intercultural translations, giving space for the voice of people and not just to the institutional positions that quite often reproduce the language and the canonic standards of the global North. Therefore, in an increasingly interconnected world where Africa is just one of the various epistemological provinces, I think it's important to explore continuously the contributions of African historical and present realities, including its recent socialist and revolutionary utopias, which is the contribution of these utopias to global politics and society. In a world that is claiming deep decolonization, I think we need to move beyond the condition of externality, where the colonial subject are still writing out of the contemporary moment. So we still don't belong to history. And I think these current protests across the world under the banner Black Lives Matter demonstrate still the lasting effects of the mission from the historical accounts of the voices of those who were most affected by colonialism, slavery, and the enduring legacies of those events of world historical significance, including the political struggles for emancipation from colonialism. But still, why are we left out of history? Why still in 21st century we have to claim to be part of history with our own voices? So I think this question of the global South that is heir to the third world, it's still a vast field of experiences and struggles for a better world, a world that respects dignity and humanity and its diversity. But still this global South that we were talking a little bit before we started the talk, it's still not assumed as a sort of theorization and explanation for events of global impact. We Africans have since long ago been claiming to be part of the world, to produce knowledge to the world. But why are we still not part of this discussion? Where is Africa in world history? And I think there are two types of Africas. The first, Africa is a place to which I identify myself, where people and culture live, and we experience conflictual legacies of long historical processes. However, I think these images are usually overshadowed by representation of Africa that has been invented, as I said earlier on, by colonial knowledge and power. And universities, research centers, museums, all that these educational institutions are places where citizenship and belonging are experienced and play quite often a role in the global north in reproducing the second image of Africa, the imperial representation of the continent. This is why to decolonize means to conduct research and to demand in parallel politically to do away with existing colonial research practices and learning processes that still bear legacies of European context and colonial rule in Africa. I'm not suggesting to do away with the books in the colonial library. No, we need to expose the fake news. We need to expose the lies of truth that these books entailed, because lies, silences, secrets, and of truths, as Marie-Louise White suggests, are integral to and part of the multiple truths that indeed construct the reality of the African continent. And over the last decades, if we see, there has been this push towards decolonization. And we have seen claims to decolonize the curricula, the university, the mind, and so on. But still, we don't pay very much attention to self-definition, how Africans are talking about decolonization, being it individual or collective, as a condition for a deep process of decolonization. This is part of a global trend, as I see it, aiming at addressing previous neglected topics regions about which we don't usually talk when you talk about global effects, to include the voice of those represented as the others, and in this construction of modernity. So I think it's the long silence of the underrepresented in the global north that we are listening now. They have been here, they are part of the world, but there is this wave that started in the 60s, in the 50s, in the 60s, in Africa and in Asia that is now arriving in Europe. So revisiting, I think, this violent impact of modern colonialism on the African continent and putting the accent in this need for this decolonizing project, it's a key to challenging the colonial and liberal desire to rearticulate again and again, and we see it over and over in North America, in Canada, in the European Union, to rearticulate the modern empire by underlining its ethical goals, as several colleagues, for instance, are attempting. Just for example, see the debates on the ethics of the colonial projects in the UK, or the critical debates now going on in France on the Islamo-gauchism, just to give you a few examples. I don't know very much what is going on in Germany, as I don't speak German, but I'm sure that you also have lots of this return of how good, how much good we did to those overseas territories, and we don't understand why they are not happy with our support. The question is, what is, can we listen to what Africans and people from the diaspora are talking about? Do we have analytical frameworks to understand their claims? And I think this is the problem to democratize history, is to create the conditions to listen and to create a dialogue from both perspectives, because quite often what we have is a very dense and large narrative about Europe, and we don't, you know, nothing about the other localities, those multiple spaces that represent the global south. So we need to construct these thick descriptions in order to generate a dialogue that will be a dialogue among contemporary realities, because otherwise it will be an exercise of imperialism. Because I know a lot about Mozambique, but some people in the world probably don't know as much as I know about the context, and will be an imperial exercise from my side, because it will be just my side of history. This is not a good way to approach decolonization. So decolonizing really requires grappling with our roots and our belonging, the way we belong to the world, learning to speak beyond the colonial project as an act of collective healing, because this is really for all of us all over the world. We need to learn to live, think, be in a different way, and to do research with people and not about people. So this is the question of intersubjectivity, and not to constantly see the others as objects of our attention, but not subjects of relations. So it asks us to reimagine ourselves in relation, invoking within us the connection to ourselves, to our ancestors, to the land, to our bodies, to the others, so that the knowledge that is inherent and deep within us can be cultivated. It asks to epistemologically deep listening. We need to learn to listen and to co-learn from other contexts. How can I listen if I don't know the language? Am I going to translate all the time through the imperial languages? These are questions I'm bringing you, because myself, I have no answers. So it also calls to reclaim knowledges that have been silenced, exiled, erased, denied, shamed, and negated. So history cannot be ignored when we consider that being, the being which defines who we are, and yet which cannot determine the becoming with which we shape ourselves. So there is a tension between what defines us and what we want to be. So I'm now going into the last 10 minutes, the third point of my talk, because when we talk about the past, usually the past, as I'm trying to explain, is dominated by the voices and the analytical framework from the global north to analyze the reality. And thus the violence, this reproduces the epistemological violence of the colonial capitalist approach, because it doesn't allow other experiences to be brought into the discussion. So Southern African experiences of collective struggle for a radical rupture with colonial and racial discriminatory historical, cultural, and political relations are quite often completely missing from these cosmopolitan debates. But what we see from the other side, since the early 20th century, the cry for African liberation has combined a political and moral struggle aimed at contributing a whole new perspective on humanity that moves away from the political legacy of subhumanity generated by slavery in modern colonial capitalist project. So these projects for self-determination need to be addressed as the core political projects that were the responsible for the deep transformations that changed African landscapes, especially since the 1960s, when the big wave of independence took place in the African continent and opened up new horizons of liberation. We have to move back to understand what happened in the 1960s. The liberation actions actually that we see are the result of awareness of communities, of oppressed groups that translate in these struggles, translates pedagogical character of these revolutionary transformations, because we understand that there was an intention to transform, was to grasp the power and to represent themselves as humans and not as subjects of the colonial representation. Yet these epistemological values and effect of these political transitions towards independence quite often are not fully apprehended. The colonization, following a very narrow approach, is mostly interpreted in most of the narratives I've been listening to as a transition to independence granted by the former empires, meaning that we listen to the decolonization narratives from the voices of the empires and not from the voices of the colonized. And we need to change that approach in order to gain a deeper and more sophisticated understanding of the political projects. Because indeed, we Africans were urged to engage with the world, both politically and academically, in order to craft, as Amilcar Cabral would say, the theoretical weapons to be used to gain our emancipation. In the 1950s, 1960s, African revolutionary and academics understood that the dominant concepts, theories, and analysis of African reality were inadequate to produce a post-abyssal way of thinking or to provide meaningful guidance for systemic transformation beyond colonialism, as Walter Rodney insisted in his analysis. But still, we have not that many analyses on the revolutionary paths in Africa, a situation that I think it's not typical just of Africa, because when you look at Haitian, Mexican, Cuban, or Vietnamese revolutions, they only see of regional or with local value. But aren't not these revolutions part of a broader ethos of liberation that this narrow Eurocentric approach cannot or is not willing to grasp? What is a revolution? The ideas of pan-Africanism, of third world cosmopolitans, were products of liberation thinking that germinated intellectual and cultural roots across the global South. If seen from this perspective, I see the third worldism as a cosmopolitan reading of the world that invokes a broad political and cultural zone of debate that emerges both from the vernacular roots of the African and Asian and Latin American realities, but that still it's compatible with the best traditions of anti-colonial revolutionary socialist projects. So this conjunction between what is going on and which are our roots is being theoretically very well addressed by people like Leopold Sandar Senghor, Kwame Nkrumah, Jules Nyerere, Eduardo Mondlane, or Amilcar Cabral. And I think this cosmopolitan thought that was at the core of African socialist projects was produced in dialogue with other contexts and that impacts also beyond Africa. These projects became vehicles for social, political, cultural transformation elsewhere because people involved in socialist projects in Africa were not just Africans, they belong to the world. And they took some of these initiatives when they went back to Latin America, to Africa and Europe. And when you were talking about the Portuguese condition, I think that the coup d'etat that led to the revolutionary return to democracy in Portugal in April 25th, 1974, is really the byproduct of liberation struggles fought in Angola, Guinea-Bissau, and Mozambique. And we can talk about it. I'm just saying that it was not Portugal that gave independence. It were these three struggles for independence that gave democracy back to Portugal. So nonetheless, and despite the relevance of the continent history to activists and revolutionaries across the world, Southern Africa, where I belong to, still remains a terra incognita in terms of scholarship regarding revolutionary transformations. And I think it has a lot to be with the limits of the mainstream scholarship that is very much focused on revolutionary socialist projects born in Europe and developed in Europe, which were shaped to present the world in a certain way, which is a regional project, but they were imposed as the reading of the revolutionary project. So this simplistic understanding needs to be debated with other projects. Because indeed, African socialist projects have deep roots. Let's remember in 1945 at the Pan-African Congress in Manchester, Nkrumah cried, "Colonial and oppressed peoples of the world unite," claiming that it was not just a question of capital, it was a question of colonialism and capitalism. And this reverberated and invoiced the struggle of Africans for the right to dignity and self-affirmation and for the recognition of Africans as political subjectivities. And therefore, all the countries, as I said earlier on, that gained independence after World War II, sought to articulate an alternative political project that wanted to overcome the divisions of the Cold War. And the principle common to various versions of African socialism, it combined the traditional socio-cultural features of equity, cooperation, humanism that in broad terms characterized the pre-modern colonization in Africa, the communal village life, with wealth and potential for organization, for solidarity of the modern production methods and state institutions that were present in this context. So this is the response. It was a revolutionary project that wanted to answer the dehumanization and exploitive situation imposed by European colonization. But still, we don't talk about the role of African workers in this revolutionary project. The claim for political autonomy, for decolonization of the mind through education and valorization of African cultural heritage became fundamental elements against the linear path of development that was implemented by colonial administrations and continue nowadays in lots of neocolonial contexts. And this is a question that was addressed by Eduardo Mondlane, by Milcar Cabral, and later on even addressed in questions regarding internal colonialism by Samir Amin, Pablo Casanova, World Wolpe, and so on. But basically, it was the right of Africans to think from their own heads, as Milcar Cabral stated, and to imagine other possible futures beyond the First and Second World, which were both Eurocentric worlds. And that was the big question about the Third World, about the non-aligned world of which the African continent was a big component. Rapidly, just to wrap it up, let's remind that Angola and Mozambique became independent in 1975, following long and bloody armed struggle. Their political emancipation was fundamental to the liberation of Southern Africa, supporting the struggle against Southern Rhodesia, colonized Southwest Africa, and apartheid South Africa. Angola and Mozambique shared the common vision of bridging with colonialism and capitalism, and with all these segregationist regimes. And their history was a history of political imaginaries developed throughout the liberation struggle in alliance with other progressive forces across the world, many of which taught and supported the hospitals and the schools in Angola, in the liberated areas of Mozambique and Angola. My question is why, as I was saying, what is a revolution if not a dramatic rupture? Since the 1960s, Africa has now all these epistemic and ontological emergencies beyond the color line, and against the cognitive degradation, it was the result of colonialism. So why don't we see this process as a revolutionary project, a rupture with colonial past in Southern Africa, being that the case of Zimbabwe, South Africa, of Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, Namibia, the key nationalist movements waged on a radical democratic proposal, where the people should choose their leaders, participate in country's governance, and take part in the discussion of country's affairs. And this revolution is very much a mirror of a radical revolutionary project, when the others were objects of political intervention, not subjects of their history. It was indeed a project that Fanon describes, Les Damnés. It was a revolution from Les Damnés, the colonized, to decide from their own heads their options of the future, being agents of their history. It was not just independence, but the right to write their own history, to assume the struggle as a right to self-determination, as self-definition, which includes also a struggle for cognitive and social justice, for land, for education, for emancipation of women, for the right of young people to speak. It was a radical political, economic, and epistemic liberation. So this is this utopian space-time of challenge reintroduced indeed new political subjects and new forms of experience in being in the world. And this has to be seen beyond this litigation of the Warsaw Pact and the NATO Pact, there was something else that needs to be addressed, because it also incorporates the aspirations of a lot of diaspora that later on continued to be sharing similar goals across the world and influence the world. Let's not forget that still when the liberation war of Mozambique was going on and the strongholds of Frelimo and MPLA were mostly in the Congo, and in Tanzania, Black Panthers of visit Frelimo in order to understand the experience of liberated areas. That it was a visit that influenced very much the political action of the movement back in the US in terms of education, support, wealth, and so on. And several of the people I've been interviewing, this is a project I'm trying to understand, they all tell the same. Tanzania was a revolutionary Mecca, visited by Che Guevara, Malcolm X, Torquay Carmichael, C.L. James, Angela Davis, Giovanni Arrighi, Eldridge Cleaver, Peter O'Neill, Walter Rodney. And later on, this was an export that moved on to continue in Luanda and Maputo. And in a good sense, as someone told me, no one was immune to the liberation revolutionary virus. So sometimes there are good virus, the revolutionary virus, it's not the COVID virus. So getting back to the question, I think we really need to move away from certain of this toxic impact of these concepts is very much associated with narrative of development in categories that link parochial interpretations about world. The resistance and liberation stories need to be addressed as utopian projects about a global world where all these people were part of and influenced the radical change in the world. Because the global empirically is constructed through various interconnections, and it's we cannot never give it to present world just in a summary saying there is the north and there is the south. The south is a very big complexity, and we need really to address it in detail, taking different cases as a reference to engage with different voices, moving beyond this dualism of North-South to understand the complexity of the South and the contributions of the South to the world. This is a project where I have learned how much I don't know, how ignorant I am about the world, and it's how important it is to learn from other theoretical structures as a condition to free our minds. In our times, decolonization, I think it's no longer limited to anti-colonial struggles, because it also has the demise of dominant approaches to the history in the global South. And it has to include the responses to decolonization now of the North, of Europe, US, Canada, and so on. And in this process, I think we need to study that decolonization also involves this new wave where the Black identity requires this radicalism as an instrument of preserving Blackness and navigating this claim of this diasporic presence in the world, even in environments where there is cultural and racism, but still it's a statement, they belong there. So it brings back the urgency for the countries of the global North to decolonize their history and then recognize the multiple African political agencies, their sophisticated institutions with cosmopolitan connections beyond the legacy of the modern colonial library. I think to see the world as being composed of interconnected revolutionary projects, it's a possibility to reinvent the world in moments of critical transformation, when sometimes the world seems not to make any sense, like we are seeing right now. So borrowing from Felwyn Sarah, who did quite interesting research about the return of stolen objects to Africa, I think our world draws from the past, both real and imagined, to depict a liberated version of the future, which is planted in African experiences. So it's a world making to imagine liberating utopia. It's about African utopias, as Felwyn Sarr talks about. And historically speaking, writing from about these processes, about the social research, involves ethics and morality, and not just evidence, because history is not just about the past, it's also about the legacy we are creating right now. So my last comment is getting back to Amílcar Cabral. When the incitement of Amílcar Cabral, hide nothing from the people, tell no lies, mask no difficulty, mistakes, failures, claim no easy victories, instead expand explanations, debates, co-learning. And I think this is the key for us to recreate the space of utopian liberation, of struggles for cognitive and social justice, a space for cooperation, which is the creolized world we are trying really to give space to. And thank you very much for having robbed 4 minutes more of my talk.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you very much for this interesting and instructive talk, and for elaborating all the aspects of African experience and the still continuing lack of interconnection and the oppressive of knowledge. And as you said before, the simplistic view of